Committee on Human Services and Housing on Monday, February 11th, 2013. Okay, I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 2676. We're going a little bit out of order. In committee, we had a brief introduction last week about housing issues. Now we're going to be hearing a group of them as they come up to us, and these are all about, as you've probably read, all about manufactured homes. So thank you so much. And Regina?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2676 is a measure that removes the sunset for mandatory cancellation of property tax assessment for manufactured structures valued less than $12,500 in some counties. There is a revenue statement that was issued and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representative Hoyle, you can come and tell us what this is all about.
Thank you. I didn't want to get up before I was recognized. I did that once this session, and I will not do that again. Thank you very much for listening to me. Val Hoyle, I represent West Eugene and Junction City, House District 14. And this is a bill that repeals a sunset from a good piece of legislation that we passed in 2010. It passed unanimously through the House and had one no vote in the Senate. And I went over to the person with the no vote and explained it. He said he would have voted yes had he known. So this bill allows Oregon's four largest counties to cancel the tax assessment on manufactured structures with an assessed value of less than $15,500. And I know in the bill it says $12,500, but that number is actually indexed, and once you have the indexing over time, it's a $15,500 in value. The reason that only four counties are included is that these are the only four counties that wanted to be included, because a manufactured home with a value of $15,500 in Multnomah County or Lane or Clackamas or Washington is quite different than a manufactured home, say, in Baker County. It's a different situation. So we only included the counties that wanted to be included, and the reason this came up was the assessor for Multnomah County noticed that when they went to collect these taxes, it actually cost them more to collect the delinquency than they were taking in. And if you think about people who are living in homes valued less than $15,500 in an urban area, these are people that are living in poverty, predominantly single women, widows. In my district, have more manufactured homes, home parks, than any other district in the state. It is a source of affordable housing, and that $100 or $150 really is the difference between making ends meet. It is a difficult burden to bear. What we do is this extends the cancellation of the tax assessment that we already give to floating homes and that we already give to floating homes and extends it to manufactured homes in this value. We had a 2-year sunset because we wanted to see if this legislation did what it was supposed to do, if it worked. It did. It has been extremely successful. The four counties that were included still very much want to have this bill passed. So I'm hoping that we can get a yes vote out of committee and vote on the floor and provide a little bit of relief to some people who really need it. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for the big testifier? All right. You did so good. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your consideration.
We have Richard Teague, Nancy Bennett. Okay. Great.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Nancy Bennett with Multnomah County, and I'm really here to answer questions about the history of the bill, if there are any. I was part of the group that helped draft this back in 2010 along with Representative Hoyle, but I really want to turn it over to Richard Teague from our tax assessor's office to talk a little bit about our experience with this bill.
Thank you, Nancy.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
What was the bill number in 2010?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsnett, I believe it was House Bill 3640, but we should double-check that.
Let's see if Representative Hoyle's team knows that.
Okay, 3640.
3640, okay.
Thank you.
All right, good. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Richard Teague. I'm the Industrial and Personal Property Program Manager for Multnomah County in the Department of Assessment and Taxation. Multnomah County supports House Bill 2676 and its elimination of the sunset clause on the mandatory cancellation of tax assessments for manufactured structures with values less than $12,500. Our experience over the past 2 years is that the tax cancellation has allowed us to reduce our costs, and also it provides tax relief to a vulnerable section of our population. It's a section of our population that has no safety net, that a broken car or a medical emergency could result in financial disaster. I need to point out at this point in time that there's a typographical error in the testimony that you received there. In the next paragraph, it states that in 2012, of the 2,429 manufactured structures in Multnomah.
Have them show
it. Oh, I'm sorry.
Look at this. Do you have it?
Sorry, it's for Lane County.
You passed something? Oh, that's okay. That's okay. Then tell us again.
At that point in time, then there's no typographical error, I guess.
That's all right. Okay. So the typographical error is what?
The typographical error is we stated that there was 2,429 manufactured structures in Multnomah County, when actually there was 4,751. The 2,429 that is mentioned are the manufactured structures that fall under the assessment threshold.
Okay.
So in 2012, of the 4,751 manufactured structures in Multnomah County, 51% were under the cancellation threshold. Manufactured structures under the threshold tend to be older and in poorer condition. The county canceled an estimated $340,210 in taxes in 2012. While it might seem counterintuitive to be cutting taxes at a time when there's a need for revenue, many of these accounts remain unpaid, and there is a high cost of billing, servicing, and collecting these accounts. In fact, we estimate that we're saving approximately $100,000 a year since the tax cancellation went into effect. We're able to reorganize and eliminated the equivalent of one position, saving us $73,000. The associated costs and fees for mailings, recording warrants, billing, and processing payments are approximately $27,000. A report that was created by the Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon in 2008 concluded that two-thirds of the households in mobile homes make less than $30,000 per year. 41% of them make less than $20,000 a year. 13% make less than $10,000 a year. 54% of those owners are 55 years or older. 29% of them are 65 or older. And 17% are 75 years or older. What this does is it paints a picture of an older demographic, an older and poorer demographic, with most of the people over 55 years old. Manufactured structures are considered personal property, and they're collected like personal property. Because of the high number of structures that we have under the threshold, we found them to be costly and difficult to collect. Collection of the delinquent taxes on these low-value manufactured structures is complicated by the demographic of the owners and the poor condition of the property. Seizure and sale of the property is allowed by statute, but it's not practical given the low value and the logistical difficulties in evicting owners, seizure, and possible relocation and resale of the property. Some of them are in such poor condition that demolition on site would be the only option. If taxpayers are unable or unwilling to pay their taxes, enforcement options are limited to us. Beyond all this discussion of cost savings and canceled taxes, this legislation directly affects some of the most vulnerable citizens in our community. They're people for which the small amount of taxes on their manufactured structures can represent a significant part of their discretionary income. Cancellation of their tax is a small price compared to the cost of the community if the county were forced to seize the property and evict the owners with limited options and no safety net. all for an average of $140 in property taxes. Multnomah County supports this legislation. Over the past 2 years, it's proven to be cost-effective for the county, in addition to providing a small amount of relief to a vulnerable segment of our population.
Richard, I did notice, Representative Hoyle mentioned that actually the value of the manufactured structures would be $15,500 or less, but in the bill itself, it still says $12,000.
Chair Tomei, that is correct. It is $15,500 currently. There's an escalator clause in 308-205, is that what it is, that increases every year. It was $12,500 when the bill was originally drafted, but now it's escalated to
$15,000. It still says that, $12,500.
Yes.
So you're saying that somewhere in the legislation it says that will escalate every year?
It's recalculated every year, yes. And currently it's $15,500.
I just can't see that anywhere in the bill itself. Can somebody locate that for me?
Give me 1 second here. In ORS 308-250, where it establishes the $12,500 cancellation threshold, under Section 4A, it goes on to say that for every tax year beginning on July 1st, the Department of Revenue shall recompute the maximum amount, and then also under 4AB, that they will recompute the maximum amount of assessed value for the taxes being canceled under subsection 2A by multiplying the $12,500 by an appropriate indexing factor determined as provided in subparagraph A of this paragraph.
Okay, we won't have a work session on this today, but I'd just like to get something in writing that states what you just said.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, President Kenny Geyer.
So, and I have a question about whether it just makes sense to start with the number that we're starting with in this current bill and still include the indexing. I'm curious, what would be the legal reason for, in this bill, dated to go into effect 2014, using the base figure from 3 years ago?
I'll attempt to answer that question, Chair Tomei. Representative Kenny Geyer, I believe that is something that the Department of Revenue, I think Legislative Council sort of determines that. I don't think it's a mistake. I think that that's how they calculate this escalator, and so it's not necessarily spelled out in this legislation. But let's clarify that for you, and we can have that. This bill also will be going to the Revenue Committee from here, so we can also clarify things in that committee as well.
Thank you.
Let's
see if there are any other questions first. Okay, thank you.
I'm Representative Tomei, members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I apologize for not getting down here in time to sign up first. I did hand out a document from our assessor, Annette Spickard, and she lays out a table that I think does a nice job in portraying the data from Lane County related to this the waiver of fees proposed under, well, that we've had since 3640 and now proposed to extend through House Bill 2676. I'd draw your attention to the, that's the 1, 2, 3, 4th row of the table that speaks to the amount of property taxes canceled in Lane County. And I want to make sure that the committee understands that that's the amount of property taxes canceled for the entirety of the 83 taxing districts that exist in the county. So, for example, Lane County, the money from the property tax system that comes to Lane County is 9 cents on the dollar. So, really, for us, the impact to Lane County itself is about $50,000 as a result of this bill. So just to make sure that the committee understands that function of the property tax system, that these dollars go distributed to all the parts of the taxing districts that are in the county. The assessor tells me that the process has been working quite well. You can see clearly in Lane County, we've actually got almost as many properties as Multnomah County, and the average value of those homes is quite low that are exempted. You know, our experience, like I said, has been from a technical and operational standpoint. She tells me it's not a very difficult program to administer, and wanted the committee to have this data from Lane County.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if Multnomah or Lane County are the right people to ask this, but you're in front of me. I understand the nature of this program, and I would think that if we're talking about a population that has difficulty paying taxes, that the owners of these particular units would have that challenge, whether they live in the largest counties of the state or in the smallest counties of the state. I would also think that no matter where those units are located, that the counties that foreclose on them and end up owning them are going to have the same kind of problems getting rid of them, whether they're in the larger counties or the smaller counties. So my question is, why is this program, why is this legislation only aimed at our four largest counties, or should we consider the option of allowing other counties to participate?
My understanding, and somebody maybe can address this, is that these were the only counties that were interested in participating. Can someone verify that, Nancy?
Sure. Chair Tomei, Representative Gomberg. This is an issue that we wrestled with a lot when we were first drafting the bill in 2010, and we, the tax assessors, have an association, and they had a lot of conversation about this, and some of the smaller counties did speak to this and said that they didn't feel that it was, an issue for them in the same manner that it was for some of the larger counties that have a lot of tax accounts to deal with, and so they were reluctant to see the loss of revenue potentially in their county. And whereas we were finding a lot of these accounts were delinquent, we were spending a lot of time trying to track these people down, and you heard the rest of that. So we worked a lot with legislative council on how could we include the counties that want to be included and not make a statewide mandate, and there's really not an elegant way of picking and choosing counties other than by population. We don't call out counties in statute, and so that was the only real way that we could, in their term, create a rational limitation to this program. So, but we would certainly have no objection to more counties joining this this policy. It would certainly make sense to us, but it's really a county-initiated change that would have to happen.
Okay. Anything else? All right, thank you very much. With that, any other questions or concerns, comments? And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2676, and we'll have a public hearing on House Bill 2165. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2165 repeals the sunset on county multidisciplinary teams that respond to allegations of abuse of adults with disabilities. There is no revenue impact issued and a fiscal impact issued.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I just stay here?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. For those that were on the interim Human Services Committee, you may recall this issue. For those of you that weren't, I'll give you a brief refresher. In 2009, we passed comprehensive legislation that addressed the abuse of adults with developmental disabilities in Oregon. And one piece of that was the requirement that each district attorney establish within their county a multidisciplinary team for vulnerable adults that would be modeled after the MDT that is done for children. MDT is a multidisciplinary team for children, but would focus on adults. And it was required in this bill that those multidisciplinary teams include local law enforcement, the district attorney, developmental disability programs, mental health programs, and aging programs, and that those would be permanent members of those teams. One of the reasons that we established this is that as we looked at the rates of abuse within the system, we found that DHS was it appeared that DHS was making referrals to law enforcement about abuse that might rise to the level of a crime, and there was question about how those reports were then followed up on. How many were investigated by law enforcement, how many went forward for prosecution by a district attorney. So these multidisciplinary teams were intended to improve that coordinated response and to better track the process by which these allegations were followed up on so that vulnerable people would have access to the criminal justice system. So that bill required that these be established and that a protocol be developed in each community to follow those allegations all the way through to the conviction process. We put a sunset on that in 2009 with the belief that once people got into the habit of this, that it would be good process and it would just continue. Unfortunately, the law did not appear to be complied with in many places around the state. So as of, was it April that we had a hearing? I'm
trying to think when it was. I can't remember.
Yes. And there were a very large number of counties that as of yet had not established their county multidisciplinary teams, or if they had done so for elders, had not included the developmental disability program. Online, there should be the spreadsheet that shows where we are today. That has now increased. There are now 30 out of 36 counties that have established multidisciplinary teams, but there are still six that have not yet established these teams. Several of the counties, a good number of them actually, are not able to provide a copy of the protocol that was required under that 2009 bill, and also a good number of them still do not permanently include developmental disability programs in their multidisciplinary teams. Because of this lack of implementation, it seems inappropriate to allow the mandate to sunset. So this bill simply removes that sunset. It's also consistent with the work that the good representative to my left worked on last session in order to improve the response to abuse of elders. And that's it.
I have a question since it's all new and I wasn't here last time. Are we asking to repeal a sunset date of January 2015? I'm just wondering, was that when it was due to sunset?
Madam Chair, Representative Woodfitt, yes.
So why would we, just trying to understand why we would repeal it in 2013 if it's good through 2015 and not wait until 2015 to repeal it, the sunset, if it wasn't being complied with at that time?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Whitfitt, because it sunsets on January 1st of 2015, we wouldn't be able to do it in time, and we would then have to come back in the short session. So this is the last long session before it would sunset.
So just as sort of a matter of, do we not repeal things in the short sessions, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Woodset, we certainly could repeal it in the short session. I think the issue here is that this was intended to go on for a longer period of time, and because the counties did not comply with the law, I think first that assumption that people would get into the habit of this regular communication around abuse may not be an appropriate assumption. And the second is that even in 2015, that wouldn't be a long enough time if you were to start today. And again, we still have six counties that are not complying with current law. There's not enough time between now and less than 2 years from now to establish that pattern of behavior.
Can I ask another question? Do we know why those six counties aren't complying? Have they gotten back to you or whoever's checking on the compliance? What is a reasoning for not complying?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitfitt, at the hearing last spring, the district attorneys talked about being very busy and a lack of resources and time to be able to put these multidisciplinary teams together. And I think at that time, the pushback that I had was that we went through a process and people agreed, and it actually was the law at that time. So it's not really a voluntary,
yeah,
requirement.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there anyone here to testify on this? Nobody has signed up? All right.
Madam Chair, I have one question.
Yes.
I don't think we're in a hostile situation, so that's not the root of this question. Maybe for the record, we ought to indicate the six counties that we're talking about.
Representative Gelso, do you have those?
I do. Let's see. The six counties would be Columbia, Gilliam.
Get right off.
Jefferson, Morrow, Sherman, and Wheeler. And those, without protocols that were readily available upon the request that went out from the Department of Justice, were Benton, Clatsop, Columbia, Coos, Curry, Gilliam, Lane Financial, Lincoln, Lynn, Malheur, Umatilla, Union, Wallowa, and Yamhill, Polk, and Sherman.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, but I think two of those counties that you've identified, Representative Gelser, do not have local public safety coordinating councils involved in them. And did you have that conversation at all where they were in talking about that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, in the spring, they're not. These are supposed to be coordinated by the DA, not by the local law enforcement coordinating committee.
The lip syncs.
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, generally what I've seen, and you've been involved in that too,
yeah.
And I understand where you're going with the bill and everything like that. There has always been the case that I've seen where the DAs have worked closely with the lip syncs to drive and move
and
forward with the law policy.
Lip syncs, sir.
Local Public Safety Coordinating Council.
Thank you.
So that's all.
You know, we also will have hearings here on extended living. That's not the exact title. What is it? Anyway, it's elderly who, and what we found is that in many of these rural counties that don't have this kind of facility, 60% of those people never get a visitor.
Yeah.
And so there is a chance that some of these people, the elderly, could be abused, and it seems to me that we have some responsibility to make sure that we have these teams up and going in all the counties, not just in the ones in the more populous counties. So I hope that we can move on this and maybe bring some of these people in to talk about why they're not doing this. I think that's what we had to do last year. Don't you need them, Mr. Kocher?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, I would say if we're sending the message that we're serious about it and we understand the difficulty in some
mm-hmm.
counties, then I think we're sending the right message by extending the sunset.
Good. Well, I'm not going to have a work session today in case any other questions come up. But this is, I think, an important issue, and I hope we follow up on this. Anything else? All right. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2165 and open up the public hearing on House Bill 2446.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2446 extends the tax exemptions for gain realized by manufactured dwelling park landlords from sales to certain associations, organizations, or housing authorities through 2020. There is a revenue statement that was issued, and there is no fiscal impact.
Great. And I think our staff put on our desks tax credit committee policy questions. And so these are the questions that we will need to respond to if we pass any of these tax credits on to the tax credit committee. So please look at those. Again, we're not going to pass these bills today. We're going to have a work session. But I want you to think of these and how we can address them as we look toward passing some of these bills. Okay, so we have some people signed up, right?
Yes.
2446. Okay, so I'm not sure what that is. Okay, John Van Landingham, right? Pat Schwach, it's good to see you, Pat. I haven't seen you in a long time.
Thank you. It's nice to see a familiar face.
Good. Chuck Carpenter, and later we will have Don Miner and Peter Hanley. Am I saying that right? I hope. All right. It's good to see you, John.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. And I'm here with Pat Schwack. We are a team. We've been pretty much a team for about 15 years of doing this advocacy. Chuck Carpenter is the executive director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, the Park Landlord Group, and he is, I believe, at this moment lobbying one of your members, and will be here as soon as he's done with that, and will join us. I have given you written testimony, and a lot of what I have to say in explaining all this has to do with the next bill as well, HB 2447. Both of them are tax expenditure bills intended to assist or help residents of manufactured home parks. Okay? So rather than repeat, when you get to 2447, I'll just say right now that my testimony relates to both of those bills. I want to acknowledge this is a complicated area, probably one that some of you are not at all familiar with. I am obsessed with the subject and have been for quite a while, and so if I go on too long, I hope the chair will give me a sign. As a lawyer, I tell my clients when they're testifying, when I want them to shut up, I'll go like this. So we'll do that. And as the chair noted, there's a subsequent referral. You're not expected to decide on the tax policy aspects of this. And in addition, there'll be an amendment to 2447 because the draft omits a couple, two other related bills, at all, I mean, two other statutes which have a sunset tied
John,
to it.
I'm going to stop you just for a minute.
Yes, ma'am.
This is just a halfway. I've been asked to open up 2447 at the same time. I can do that, right? And can anybody? Okay. So I'm going to open up the House bill, the public hearing on House Bill 2447, so that your testimony can affect both bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my job, I think, is to explain both bills, explain why they're important to manufactured home park residents, and explain why we want you to support them. 2446 exempts from personal and corporate income tax the capital gains benefit to landlords when they sell their parks voluntarily to park residents, nonprofits, or housing authorities. I'll talk more about that later. But that's what 2446 does. It's a capital gains break to landlords who sell their parks to preferred buyers. 2447, and I would note 2473, which is identical, and I don't know why it was introduced, but they do the same thing, provides a $5,000 refundable tax credit to residents of parks who are displaced by a park closure. Okay. Both of them have sunsets of 2014. Both bills would extend that sunset to 2020. Okay. Both were initially adopted in a bill sponsored by Representative Crummell from Wilsonville in 2005. That bill passed both houses unanimously. It was introduced very late in the session. Pat and I were reminiscing about sitting in his office in June of 2005 trying to figure out what we could do about park closures. And the bill that was introduced included both of these tax expenditures as a way to try to address that crisis. Both of them were significantly amended and extended in 2007 by a bill that was negotiated and introduced by the Manufacturers Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition, which Pat is going to talk about. And I finally shut up. That bill included a number of things to try to address the impacts of park closures on residents. One of them was, two of them were these two tax expenditures. But another one was to require park landlords, for the first time, to actually pay some money to residents who are displaced to help them deal with the cost of displacement. And those payments are $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000, depending on the size of the manufactured home. Prior to that bill, manufactured housing park landlords did not have to pay any money to park residents. They could close a park with a one-year notice, and that was it. Because these two things have sunsets, they don't have an ORS number. That's the way LC does ORS, and I've printed them for you in my handout if you want to read them. I'm not going to read them to you. Both are currently having minimal fiscal impact. That's because, with regard to the capital gains break, There aren't that many parks that we that are sold to the residents or to a nonprofit or to a housing authority. We're hoping that will increase over time. It's something we're working on, and Peter Hanley with CASA is our entity that is helping residents figure out whether that works and whether they can do it. It probably won't work very well for higher-end parks where the homes cost a lot more and the price would be a lot more. But so the cost impact is not great from that particular one. The tax credit for displaced residents, it doesn't have much of an impact because, thank God for residents anyway, because of the housing crash, we're not having park closures. Park closures pretty much stopped in 2008, 2009. Someday the housing market will come back. Unfortunately, someday park closures will probably come back, although we're hoping it won't come back with the steam that they had in 2005 and 6 and 7. Let me talk a little bit about manufactured housing park living and why this is important to them. Parks are essentially residential subdivisions where the residents own their own manufactured homes and rent the land underneath them. The legal definition is four or more spaces. There are quite a few manufactured homes that are not in a park. They're either on land that somebody owns, in which case they're treated as if they're a stick-built home, or they're on rented land, often in rural areas, and they're not in parks. So this stuff doesn't apply to them. Some people refer to these parks as gated communities for low and moderate income people. They are communities where the landlord is providing the utility hookups and often a community room, but the residents are there because they want to downsize their lives or their starter homes and it's affordable, and they want a sense of community. They want someone to notice if they don't pick up the morning newspaper or they don't show up for Canasta on Wednesday night. And that's what they get in a park. The cost to buy a manufactured home in a park ranges from $5,000 to $200,000. There are parks where manufactured homes cost a lot of money. So we're not, I mean, it's a huge range of I'm getting an incredulous look, but I'll take you to a park in Eugene where the homes sell for $200,000, Sunbrook. So it's a huge range of people that are served in these houses. They are homeowners, and they are proud of it. The first time I met Pat Schwach, she wanted to make sure that I knew that she owned her furniture and she didn't rent it like a lot of tenants. It took her a while to come to trust me, since I represent tenants as a legal aid lawyer. And they are a form of tenant because they rent their land, but they're an unusual form of tenant because they own their home. They own the building they live in. The parks are considered to be the largest privately provided source of affordable housing in the United States. So when we talk about affordable housing, and that's a lot of what I talk about and what you'll hear in this session again, this is the largest privately provided source of affordable housing in the entire United States. It's important that we find ways to continue it, both privately owned and resident owned. They're often the preferred choice for starter families, for farm worker families, for low-income families, for seniors. Seniors in particular because of the community aspects and the desire to downscale and get rid of that big house with a big yard that they had to take care of. Our data indicates that park residents have, two-thirds of them have incomes of less than $30,000 a year, over half are over 55, and over a quarter are women living alone. Over a quarter are women living alone. More seniors over 65 live in parks than live in subsidized housing in this country. I mean, it's a hidden source of housing, but it's incredibly important to the country. There are 1,100 parks in Oregon with 63,000 spaces. So we're talking about a lot of people. In the mid-2000s, there was a crisis of park closures. That's what prompted these two property tax measures, two tax measures. Park landlords have the right to close their parks. We regulate how they close them, but we can't prevent them from closing. They have the right to do that. Many parks, older parks, were built on land that was zoned and intended for use for some other use. They were put on commercial spaces. You can probably think of older parks in your communities that are on commercial strips that were, in those early days, they were viewed as temporary uses, just as mobile homes were viewed as temporary, as mobile, and someday they would be used for something else. But since the 1980s, parks have been put on residentially zoned land, and people like me who pay attention to the land use and those sorts of things, never anticipated that those parks would close. But what happened in the go-go days of the mid-2000s was that parks became a target for redevelopment. They are flat, they are large, they are serviced, they are inside UGBs. They were built often on the fringes of communities which had grown out to them, and they have very little infrastructure. So developers were literally cold calling park owners and offering them buckets of money to buy their park and convert it. In 2005 and 2006, 31 parks in the metro Portland and Central Oregon areas closed, displacing, 1,500 spaces. When you are evicted from your park, and a park closure is a mass eviction. Thunderbird, one of the more prominent examples in Wilsonville, just off I-5, had something like 400 spaces. Yeah. Those residents are almost uniformly going to lose their homes. Manufactured homes typically only move once, from the dealer to the space. They're not mobile anymore. They're well built, but especially older ones can't withstand the stress of moves. The cost to move a modern manufactured home is estimated by us, by the people of our coalition, at between $15,000 and $25,000 to break it down, move it, and then set it back up again. And many other parks won't take older mobile homes, or they don't have the spaces for them. So when your park closes, you typically lose your home, you lose the equity in your home, and more importantly, you lose that community. You lose the neighbors that took care of you, that took you to the doctor's office, that paid attention to you. So for them, it was viewed as a disaster. Park residents worry, I think, about three big things: management, rents, and closures. With management, Pat will talk about this, the coalition got you all to adopt in 2005 law requiring park managers to do continuing education so they know the law. With regard to rents, Oregon prohibits rent control by local governments. So our strategy has been to encourage landlords who want to sell those to entities that won't raise the rents or will raise the rents as little as possible. That's what the capital gains break is intended for. And then with regard to closures, our strategy was to require the landlords to pay something, the 579, and the $5,000 tax credit. Those were our strategies for dealing with those things. I do want to note, because on Wednesday you had a hearing on housing community services. Housing community services does have a bit of a role in all this, but not significant in these two bills. Department of Revenue does, because that's who manages both the tax credit and the capital gains break. HCS is required by our bill to write a form notice that the landlords give to tenants when they close the parks, telling them about the tax credit. But that's HCS's really only role with regard to these two bills. HCS has a much bigger role with regard to park residents and park landlords. Housing Community Services.
Thank you.
Margaret Van Vliet testified before you on Wednesday. So HCS runs a program called the Manufactured Communities Resource Center, which used to be called the old Mobile Home Ombudsman. And that program is funded by a $6 annual assessment that the residents imposed upon themselves. They taxed themselves to support that program. And the MCRC, the Manufactured Community Resource Center, provides education, mediation for both landlords and residents, and also helps with the monitor the education requirement and helps with park closures. So that's my pitch for these two bills, and Pat's going to talk about...
John, first, I'm going to see if people have any questions. Okay. I just want to say I was here in the legislature, and I think you were too, in 2005.
Yeah, when that happened.
And this was a crisis. We needed housing for people, and it was like this was just the beginning of this explosion that was going to be happening, because the property was fairly inexpensive, and people were coming from out of state to buy these properties. And even if they allowed the homes on there, there were out-of-state owners who didn't care about keeping up the property. So there were huge, huge issues and problems, and I appreciate you being involved at that time and coming up with some constructive ways of dealing with these issues. So thank you. Hi, Pat.
Yes, I'm Pat Schwach. I'm a resident in the Manufactured Home Park in Newburgh. John's pretty well explained what goes on and the things that have happened. I want to say again that manufactured park living is very good, particularly for seniors. I was thinking about it this morning, and everybody that I know for blocks around has an animal that they walk every day. And those who don't have animals that get out and walk have cats that they pay attention to. And that's become very important to them. And one of the things that we managed to get in some of our legislation was a ruling that the landlord could not charge you or me for our pets. They had what was called pet rent, and it could be as much as $25 a month per critter. So that was pretty painful. The Committee of Seven was a committee that we managed to get put together because there were so many things that were occurring throughout the park. And before this Committee of Seven came together, we had what were called landlord meetings once a year with the landlord. And they were nothing but a terror because the landlord showed up and he didn't want to be there in the first place because he was going to talk about raising your rent. And the residents went with a look that said, well, what are you going to do now? So it was pretty bad. we've certainly arranged some additional pass-throughs for residents. The issues continue to arise in these parks, I think, because as the parks age and so do the people, there's things that need to be talked about. One of the things that the landlords are required now to do is to give a 5-year rent history so that people coming in get an idea that, yes, they do raise the rent, because that got to be a real shock to an awful lot of people. I think I've pretty well laid out, in as brief a title as I can, what's in this group, and I understand you've got lots going on, and you don't need me any longer than that.
Thank you, Pat. Madam Chair, could I add, what Pat is doing is describing some of the things that the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition has negotiated over the years and brought to the legislature, and the legislature's adopted. I met Pat in 1997 in a committee hearing in which then Senator Kennemer essentially said to the landlords and the tenants who were fighting over a park issue to go out in the hall and don't come back until they'd reached agreement. And that was how the coalition was formed, and that's how we've operated since 1997. We've had a compromised negotiated bill every session, including 1997. So what's that, 11 sessions or so? It's not easy. It's not, if I were king, it's not what I would write, but it is effective, and it's worked for us. There will be a compromise negotiated bill, we hope, this session that you'll see from that coalition. And Pat's been a key member of that coalition since 1997 and is describing some of the things that we've accomplished there. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Litton. All right. Thank you very much. Let's see. Here's the list. So we have Chuck Carpenter, Don Miner, and Peter Hamley. Is that correct?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 500 manufactured home communities here in the state of Oregon, and we also conduct seminars on fair housing, proper management of manufactured home communities. Typically, right now, we're educating about 600 managers of communities every year. So, and we have been a participant of the Manufactured Housing Coalition since 1997. I've personally been on the coalition since 1999, and prior to that, I was sitting where you folks are listening to these nasty fights between landlords and tenants. And I think the coalition has, over the years, done a really superb job of allowing us during the interim to find solutions that are acceptable to both parties. These are very emotionally charged issues that in which we have two people with major assets on top of each other, literally, and the issues are very, very hard to sometimes to find solutions. There will be a coalition bill this year on issues that are concerned to both landlords and to residents, and I'm very proud of that fact. So, and we will continue to be committed to this process, realizing that all of you have the final vote on the product that we turn into you, but we struggle hard to find proper compromises so that it is a fair situation for both the resident and for the landlord. For landlords, I mean, to have a situation where residents do not want to remain in a community or move into a community just is not good business sense. And so we're always trying to find solutions so that people will want to live in manufactured home communities. So.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Committee, I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. Our members are the manufacturers, retailers, lenders, companies that supply the building materials. We're the suppliers of the homes, and we support both of these bills. I think John related to you that through the 90s into early 2002, 2003, there are a large number of manufactured home communities being built in this state. You know, and as land became more scarce, prices increased, the park owners and developers weren't able really to compete for that land. And that became fairly severe as developers began buying rental communities, even new communities. I think there was one in Washington County, I think it was Baseline Woods or West, a relatively new community, a newer community in West Lynn where homes, three-car garages in rental communities closed and the land converted to another use. And this is just devastating to the homeowners. They're forced to move, and it's, as John pointed out, it's very, very expensive, and not a lot of places to move to then. And so the better outcome would be to preserve that rental community as a park. And so the capital gains forgiveness that allows a park owner who's going to sell to not pay as much in tax if he sells it to the tenants or to a nonprofit corporation, I think is good public policy. It preserves affordable housing and protects a vulnerable population. I think John related some of those demographics, but a lot of them are fixed income elderly, large number of females. If you can avoid forcing them to move where they lose their houses, I think that's a good policy. I think John also pointed out the tax credit if they are forced to move, up to $5,000. That is matched by landlords who have agreed to pay the resident from $5,000 to $9,000 to help in their relocation. And I think that's a good public policy. It eases what is otherwise a very traumatic experience. It's going to be traumatic anyhow. I mean, you lose your house. You probably owed some money on the house, so you aren't made whole. Good news is, though, that I think the 5, 7, and 9 that goes to the resident comes in front of or without regard to the lender. So there, I think both bills are good bills, and we'd like to see them go forward. And I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Don. Any questions?
Yes,
Representative Kenegar.
Madam Chair, I just want a clarification. So if a tax credit is, say, $3,000, then the landlord matches that amount to help toward moving expenses?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's my understanding the $5,000 tax credit is a refundable tax credit. It goes to the resident without regard to their tax liability. The $5,000, $7,000 or $9,000 goes to the resident based on the size of the home. So if it's a single-section home, they get $5,000. So in that case, the resident would go away with $10,000.
Thank you.
Or more. Well, if it was a single-section home, it'd be $10,000.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation in Sherwood, Oregon, also known as CASA of Oregon. We've been doing manufactured housing park preservation for the last 5 years. We've converted 5 parks throughout the state. We base our model on the successful New Hampshire Community Loan Fund model, which has gone on to form an organization called Rock USA, which has a number of organizations throughout the country that help residents to purchase the parks where they live. So what we do is we go in, organize the parks, help them put the financing together, then we provide long-term technical assistance to help them own and operate those parks. The basic premise is if they can have land tenure, they control their future. They control any future rent increases. They basically control the rules. We don't have to worry about who's trimming the trees, whether it's the landlord or the resident. They're taking care of it. So when we got into this business, there were a number of laws that needed to be changed. We needed to have a thing that you could actually do this under a nonprofit co-op, so that was taken care of. This exemption from capital gains was one of the key carrots to get the owners to come talk to us. Owners typically want to just do a transaction with a sophisticated investor that can put the money on the table when they say they're going to put the money on the table. And so what we wanted to do was be able to go to these folks and be able to say, hey, we're going to work on behalf of the residents. Let's make an offer. Let's make a deal. Let's make this happen. And so we're basically creating a competitive investor that can go out there and make an offer to purchase these parks. This has been some pretty incredible work. I've been doing farm worker housing for the last 20 years at Casa Vorg, and we've been in the business for 25 years. That's pretty satisfying work, but this stuff is incredible. Getting these folks to own and operate their own parks, I've seen a transformation in these people's lives as they've been able to do some of this stuff. And so I would really encourage you to pass 2446 with a due pass recommendation on to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I have a question, Peter. So when someone passes away, what happens to their home?
So, Madam Chair, when somebody living in a park that's controlled by, okay, this is probably going to be something that Don could probably answer, but okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so your question is, if I understand this correctly, is when someone passes away, they have nobody else living in the home.
Right.
In many cases, the home is typically paid off. What will happen is that if there's no heirs or whatever, it would go through an abandonment process. And typically, Madam Chair, often on these homes, there are back taxes owed because of senior deferral or they haven't been paying taxes. And very often, after we go through a process, an abandonment process in which there's a 60-day notice given out to all the lien holders, anybody who may have a stake in the home, then the home is put up for a sealed bid. The landlord cannot purchase the home unless he or she wants to pay all the back taxes. And one of the crises that we're sort of facing right now in the industry is that we are losing a valuable supply of affordable housing because, let's say, this home was in a community for 20 years, it was occupied for 20 years, and the person had done maybe 20 years of senior deferral. The home may only be worth $9,000 and have $20,000 in back taxes owed. The way the law currently reads is that the landlord cannot purchase that home without paying the $20,000 in taxes. So if nobody buys the home, which is unlikely because of the taxes that are owed on it, then the home is simply destroyed, simply because of the tax issue. So what we're dealing with, and it was a law that we came up with several years ago, is the landlord is not allowed, the community owner is not allowed to buy the home, even though there may not be anybody else interested in the home. They cannot purchase the home unless they want to pay the price of the house and pay the back taxes.
Well, that's startling information. But it costs a lot to destroy the home, right?
Well, it costs about $6,000-$8,000, and if it has asbestos, it could be even more. And so we're losing these homes, and landlords are concerned because, and many times, the landlord would like to acquire the home. and try to renovate it, clean it up, put it back on the market. And typically, members, community owners are not making money on the home itself. They just want a space to rent. But if there is so much in taxes owed, then it simply does not make economic sense for somebody to pay $25,000 for a home that's maybe only worth $9,000. But because of this tax issue, they having to pay the tax issues becomes a problem.
That situation, but Peter was aimed more toward what you were saying about resident-owned communities. So I own a manufactured home in one of these resident communities, and I've died. And see, I have no taxes owed in the house, so the house is paid off. I own part of the park.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a cooperative ownership, so you own it's not even a share. You own basically a membership. It's a very small buy-in. It's less than $500. A lot of times it's $100 to buy into it. So you don't, the cooperative owns the park and then leases the land back to you. Okay?
So when I die, I have no...
So when you die, the co-op board is going to go through the same process that was just described. That Chuck just described.
So I'm wondering if there isn't a better way. John? Say, John wants to speak.
Can I take your chair, Don?
John Van Landingham. The statute that Peter's referring to is in Chapter 62. It's the co-op chapter, and it has to do, we created a special form of nonprofit cooperative in which the residents own the nonprofit and the nonprofit owns the land. If you were to be a member of that co-op and you were to die, your heirs...
Assuming, I have no heirs.
Okay. If you have no heirs, then your property is going to probably end up belonging to the co-op, and the co-op is a charity, and the charity would dispose of it as it wishes. It would presumably sell it to someone else who would live in the park, because its goal, like private landlords, is to have all the spaces full.
Right.
So if you have no heirs, I don't believe the home is going to be thrown away.
Okay.
The homes that are going to be thrown away are the ones that don't have any value. The issue that Chuck raised a minute ago is, I understand Chuck's perspective. The county assessors have a different perspective. not surprisingly. And so that provision in the abandoned property statute is very narrowly drawn, and while it may sound unfair, as Chuck described it, it would not be easy to amend it. And that particular statute, 90.675, is 6 pages long of ORS. It's the most complicated statute probably in the entire 15 volumes, and amending it would drive me crazy. But, if it's something you want to do, we could certainly work on it. But I wouldn't. I'm going to beat him up when we get out of here.
Well, I go visit my mobile home parks that are in my district. That many of these people are elderly. And they're obviously going to die. So then I'm just concerned that we don't lose that piece of housing, that somehow that
if the housing is usable, okay. There is a way for landlords to get ownership, and landlords do get ownership of
manufactured homes.
Landlords of the park.
Got it.
Not Peters is a different situation.
Okay.
Those are resident-owned communities.
Right.
In privately owned communities, landlord-owned communities, landlords do get possession of those manufactured homes. Either the person sells them or the heirs. I don't know how many people die without any heir or anybody that's a designated person that can make some. We've actually got addressed that in the abandoned property statute for what happens when someone dies alone. And there's a requirement that the landlord give notice to the state and to a number of people so we can try to find somebody who would take responsibility for that home and sell it, presumably to the landlord, often to the landlord, and the landlord could then resell. The example that Chuck has is where there's nobody, and it essentially gets, and plus it's not of any value to be resold.
Well, with all due respect, We'll have to talk about this in the 2015 coalition.
Again, please.
My name is Chuck Carpenter, Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We deal with this on a regular basis, where and the key here being that there's an exorbitant amount of taxes owed on the home. And so after the 60-day notice that the landlord gives to the lien holders and Department of Revenue, if there's back taxes due and all this stuff, and nobody's comes forward signing a storage agreement to store the home on the landlord's property, then we go into a sealed bid where the landlord puts a notice in the paper and says that there's this home located in such and such a community, a single wide, and maybe a minimum bid amount that would cover legal expenses, taxes, and things like that. If nobody buys that home, then the option then is for the landlord could possibly buy it. But often, Madam Chair, that is not an option for a landlord if there's so much in taxes owed on it.
Yeah.
So it becomes a business decision. Is it cheaper for him or her to destroy the home and cost $8,000 to destroy the home, or to pay, you know, $500 for the home and $15,000 in taxes? Well, the business decision may be, sometimes, you know, the landlords will say, well, the value of having a home in that space, I'm willing to pay that. And other times it's like, you know, I'm just not willing to pay that amount of money. And so the home is destroyed, the space is empty, and most likely will stay empty for a good long time.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. Any questions?
Yes.
Oh, is somebody over here?
Oh, I just had a question about the general. Oh, I just forgot what I was going to
call it. Wait a minute.
Yeah, I will.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding 2447, gentlemen, forgive me if this sounds harsh, but I'm an 86-year-old single woman, and my park's been sold. I can't relocate my unit. I've got no place else to go. What does a $5,000 tax credit do for me? What's the problem that credit solves?
Madam Chair, Representative Gumberg, the $5,000 tax credit plus the $5,000, $7,000, or $9,000 from the landlord, those two payments together, so somewhere between $10,000 and $14,000, are meant to compensate the tenant in some small portion for the loss of her home in that situation, and that she would be able to use that money to rent someplace else. It's unlikely that she'd be able to move her home. As I described in my testimony, it's difficult to move manufactured homes, especially after they're older. So it's not a full compensation. It's a very small partial compensation, but as in most things that get negotiated through coalitions, it's a compromise.
It's not so much a follow-up, it's just restating the question again. I understand we're talking about some small compensation for the problem, but does it solve any problems? You can't buy a new home for the money, you can't move your old home for the money, and you can't get into a rental situation, possibly, for the money. So is it solving a problem, or is it just saying, we really feel bad for you, here's a little bit of a boost on your way out?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Gumberg, I believe it does solve a problem in terms of helping them find a place they can afford to rent. So they're most likely to become renters. They're also going to have to move things like the furniture, because they own the home and they have furniture in the home. So, or they can leave that and abandon that as well. They're going to have to pay deposits at the new place they move to. They're going to have to hook up utilities at the new place they move to. So you've probably been a renter. Most of us have been renters at some point in our lives. There are costs to starting a new rental. So they are, those funds are intended to help people transition to the next place. We don't really have good data on where people go from park closures. The landlords who close are required to tell Housing and Community Services how many people sell their homes or move their homes or abandon their homes, but we don't really have a way to track those people. After Wilsonville has been in the news a fair amount because of the Thunderbird Park. The owner of that park, Wilsonville, adopted a very, I would say, aggressive ordinance regulating park closures. The park owner sued. The Clackamas County Trial Court found it to be unconstitutional. That decision was appealed by the city to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals reversed. By the time the Court of Appeals had reversed, the market was gone. So the $50 million that the owner thought he was going to get for his park was gone.
Bankrupt.
He went bankrupt. But they ended up negotiating a deal, his heirs, who wanted to sell it to somebody else who was going to develop it, not for $50 million, but, and they negotiated a deal with the city as a compromise to settle the litigation, and they produced some money. Maybe, I think it was around $300,000. They had a hard time finding the residents who had been displaced from that park, but they were all over it. Some of them were living with relatives, some of them had gone to nursing homes, some of them had gone to live in apartments. And all of them, I believe, would feel like they had a cost in having to make those moves and that they were not fully compensated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't mean to sound unsympathetic, but I didn't have the benefit of the original legislation here. We're extending a sunset, and I'm trying to flesh out the record a little bit just to get a clearer sense of what the problem is that we're addressing and how this approach does, in fact, address it.
President Whitsitt.
Thank you for allowing me to remember what I was going to ask.
What does the destruction entail? You talk about the destruction. Do you pull it off the site or tear it down?
Basically, Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, basically it's torn down, put into a dumpster, and taken to a landfill.
Okay. And there, Peter with CASA, Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, in some cases you can recycle some of the materials, so there are a few organizations that will go in and recycle the materials as well.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. So the $5,000, $7,000, or $9,000 that the landlords have to pay the people who have to move, that's compensation for the home. Is there anything over and above that? Say the home was worth $20,000. Is there any for the actual cost of the home? And do they get to keep that home? And does the landlords get to keep that home and do what they want with it, sell it?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, the resident has the right to try to sell the home, but the home will have to be moved because the park is going to be demolished and the land redeveloped for something else. So, if the resident leaves the home, one of the provisions in the 2007 legislation was that even though there's a cost to the landlord to destroy that manufactured home, the landlord can't charge the resident for that. So that's another way to try to help the residents deal with the fact that they're losing their homes and the value of their homes. But the $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000 plus the $5,000 tax credit is all the cash they get.
Unless they're able to also sell their
home. If they sell the home, they still can do those things, but that's, we think, rare.
I see. Representative Gilliam.
Madam Chair, I wanted to get back to not just sort of the difficulty at the end, but also what's happening now. John, you kind of touched on this, and Madam Chair, I came in 07, and this was very much alive in consumer protection, so I'm having a horrible deja vu. John Lanningham was here so much, I thought he was the representative from Lane County. 1,100 parks, 63,000 spaces, and you're representing right now 5 conversions to ownership. Where are we in this in climate where, yes, the pressure's off from developers coming in from other places and saying, hey, clear it. But are we growing? I'm not necessarily saying that's a positive thing because of the economy, but are we growing? Are more parks not just converting, but are we in a shrinking pool or is it growing? Can you say a little word about that?
We're in a shrinking, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, we're in a shrinking pool. I mean, both in terms of the number of parks and in terms of the number of homes in those communities for a variety of reasons. That we have a financial crisis in which it's very hard to find people, organizations, banks that are willing to come in and finance the sale of a manufactured home in a community. That responsibility has now been deferred to the community owner, who is now not only managing the community and his landlord, but also is the banker and providing the funding for people to buy these low-income homes. I don't think there's been a park built in the last probably 15 years.
No.
10, 15 years. I mean, not so, and there's also just this is a struggling industry for, you know, a variety of reasons. We struggle with the park closure issue seems to have gone away because we've the housing boom of 5-10 years ago when we were in the thick of it with the park closures seems to be over for the time being and is likely to be for the foreseeable future. But this is not a healthy industry. It has a lot of issues that that need both, you know, residents need help, but landlords need some help too in clarifying this and being able to have the financing so that people can buy manufactured homes and move in and live in a community. So when we have a situation where landlords are destroying homes that are really decent homes, they really just need maybe $5,000 or $8,000 of repair, and they're destroying it for a variety of reasons, because there's nobody willing to have with money to be able to buy the home, or because of the taxes and that issue. That's not the sign of a healthy industry.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up quickly. Those are helpful and good reasons, the way you prioritize them, so I'm not denigrating that. What about, you say a variety of reasons. Is there a possibility that land use laws and zoning, if they change, we'd have more opportunity? Would there be folks interested, landlords and so forth?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, if I, Don Miner for your record. It's not healthy, and in large measure, land use. There's a scarce supply of land inside of urban growth boundaries for a relatively low-density form of housing, usually 6 to 8 houses to the acre, probably closer to 6 than to 8. The land use laws in this state encourage high-density housing. So, you know, land is priced accordingly, and I think since the last legislature, we've closed either 3 or 4 factories. We're down to 5. Maybe it's 5 factories. I think we've closed 2 factories in your district, 1 in Central Oregon. But it's the problems transcend Oregon. I mean, the new federal legislation, Dodd-Frank legislation, regulations dealing with mortgage loan originators. I think there'll be a bill coming to the part of a coalition bill, but so that if the landlord wanted to finance the home, carry the contract because there's a scarcity of lenders or the consumer's credit has been bruised in the downturn, he can't do it unless he goes and gets a mortgage loan originator license, which he couldn't even qualify for. He wouldn't meet the criteria of having been a loan originator. So he can't carry the contract. There's just so many hurdles. Lenders are unwilling to extend credit to dealers. Factories are struggling. To keep the factories going in this state, we're hauling homes to Calgary and to the oil fields of North Dakota. We sold 500 houses out of those 5 factories into this state last year. Our all-time high was 15,000. It's a bad problem that transcends just the park and just the land use laws in Oregon.
Peter
Hanley with CASA. I'd just add that you guys all got a presentation last week from Oregon House Community Services, and I brought some information that I didn't have last time that'll describe things a little bit, so hopefully this will help. And thanks for indulging me on the whiteboard last week. There's some great opportunities here with the transition at Oregon Housing Community Services. This is a very effective, efficient, and affordable way to do housing in certain parts of the state, particularly in those areas where you've got some lower land prices. I think as the department is looking at restructuring themselves, when we're looking at the possibility of building or creating housing that is perhaps half the cost of what the current housing is if you're building it stick-built, we've got to take some real serious looks at the opportunities that are presented through using manufactured housing parks and manufactured homes.
Thank you. Thanks, any quick questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, I'd like to amen what you're saying. I'm disappointed Mr. Bennett is not here. I think that his organization should be supporting you as far as the land use, and this is acceptable form of housing as our population ages, and it satisfies a lot of people, would satisfy. So I'll be sure and hope you will talk to him about his organization supporting some of the things that you mentioned. That would be very helpful, and the nonprofit organization. But we have plenty of land in Central Oregon, but we have to cut junipers down. You know, they eat up a lot of water. So.
Any other quick questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming today. So we will be having work sessions on these two pieces of legislation, but I'm going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2446 and 2447. So, colleagues, if you could also... Oh, there's nobody else that's coming to testify. If you could also look at the materials that Regina has given us regarding the tax credits. And I'm going to just briefly read those so we can be thinking about this. What is the public policy purpose of this credit? Is there an expected timeline for achieving this goal? Who directly benefits from this credit? Does this credit target a specific group? Is it effectively reaching this group? What is expected to happen if this credit fully sunsets? Could adequate results be achieved with a scaled-down version of the credit? What would be the effect of reducing the credit by 50%? What background information on the effectiveness of this type of credit is available from other states? Is use of a tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve this policy goal? What are the administrative and compliance costs associated with this credit? Would a direct appropriation achieve the goal of this credit more efficiently? What other incentives are available that attempt to achieve a similar policy goal? Could this credit be modified to make it more effective or efficient? So just think about that. I'm not sure who is supposed to come up to answer these. Is that you? I hope it's you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would help you answer those questions if you choose to move this bill forward over to its sub-referral committee. Then you can call upon me and I would be able to provide additional information.
That's wonderful news. Good. All right. Any other questions or comments for the good of the order? If not, I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you all for coming today.